Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 29th, 1998. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Paul Rohde. Today's session number is 98-3 and it's titled, Thy Will Be Done, Jesus in Gethsemane. Let's listen in.
For those of you I've not yet met, my name is Paul Rohde. I'm a pastor when I'm not at Holden Village. I guess in some ways I'm a pastor even when I am at Holden Village. And I'm delighted to be with you in Bible study this week. We have been listening to the prayers of people in the scriptures. Yesterday we listened to the prayers of the Israelites in the wilderness. Today we're going to listen to the prayer of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Before we turn to that passage, I just want to give you a brief P.S. about yesterday. One of the things I love about teaching in a place like the Village is that the conversation circulates back and I learn marvelous things. Wasn't too long after the study yesterday, I was given a conversation about anorexia. It was very interesting to me because when I talked about hunger, remember we were using the verb hunger, I hunger as a word for prayer. And I was trying to say that beneath that, I hear lots of power issues, which is to say either in a response to that we are empowering or we are weakening. I was thinking about third world kinds of things. People who are chronically hungry, and I don't mean that just internationally, there are people in our own country who are hungry. But it was stunning to me to have this conversation kind of turn that piece on me in a new way. If you've not seen it, I would recommend the book Reviving Ophelia by Mary Pfeiffer. It's called Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls or something like that, isn't it? The subtitle. Anyway, in her discussion of anorexia, she talks about some of the subtle power of sexism working in our culture. And the way an anorexic sort of claims her power by giving back to the culture what the culture is telling her body should be in a really perverse denial of authentic hunger. And we had some discussion here about the power of being able to claim what we need. And I was thinking of, as I said, globally hungry people when I said that. I was really grateful for a conversation that turned that back on us in ways that we're really denying the hunger of people right among us. So sometimes when you think the text is a window, it turns out to be a mirror, and it's very helpful. Today, because we're talking about the will of God, I thought it might be fitting to contradict myself right out of the chute, okay? So I want to say straight up that we are not going to define or resolve the will of God. There were a couple of people at 7:45 that wanted their money back. Okay, if that's what you need to do. I just think that even if we took off from that and said, we're going to talk about the will of God, that would be very helpful. Our focus is going to be to listen to Jesus' prayer and to hear Jesus pleading for the will of God, to make of that prayer what we can for what we need to learn about seeking and exploring the will of God. Having said that, I am going to make a couple comments about the will of God. I'm thinking about Paul Cantino's sessions on attentiveness. And the other day, he used a Simone Weil essay that talked about the need for attentiveness to empty us. What do we mean by emptiness? Well, it meant a whole bunch of things in the discussion. But some of it is paying attention to preconceived notions so that we can hear new ideas. If we think we already know, then it's very hard to hear new ideas. That's some of that emptiness. So I just wanted to play for a few minutes here with pictures that may or may not rumble around in us about the will of God. How many of you have seen the Disneyland parade? Okay, fair number of folks. Well, as you can imagine, it's very colorful, very animated, moves down Main Street of Disneyland or Disney World. In either Magic Kingdom, it's the same. One of the things that was most amazing to me seeing it is that the people on the floats are singing, and their sound is amplified, so the sound is coming through speakers behind you, but the whole thing is moving, and you hear behind you what's in front of you exactly when they're in front of you, and then the next float comes and they're singing a different song, and then you hear that, and it's like the it's synchronized so precisely. It's just amazing. Some friends of ours who lived in Los Angeles said that when Disneyland advertises for people to work there, for openings, positions they've got, they advertise by height, so that when the parade comes down the street, the chorus lines are exactly the same height.
Oh my God.
To every detail, this is choreographed and harmonized, and it's magnificent. I think there's sometimes we think of the will of God like that. Maybe when you see a model of the solar system, you know, the way the revolutions and the rotations and the centripetal and centrifugal forces are working, and the order is just... That's a picture. Another picture is herding sheep. I grew up in South Dakota. My first call was in South Dakota. I spent a day on a sheep farm. Sort of scary to admit this because some people will call pastors shepherds, but one day with sheep was enough for me. There is still this sense of movement, you know? But there are also holes and wolves and disease and stupidity and rebellion and all kinds of other things operative. It seems to me sometimes that's a picture of the will of God. It's this movement of creatures toward purpose, but it doesn't have any synchrony at all. It's a choreographing sheep would really be a trick. And so what I'm trying to put in front of us is a continuum order. On the one end, there's precision that's very harmonious and together. And the other side, there's chaos. And probably at various times, we're someplace in between. Now, I am not the person to teach you chaos theory. I regret that I'm not, but I won't even try. Very interesting things being explored philosophically and scientifically that suggest that order needs chaos. Mm-hmm. And maybe the one quick example we could just think about for a minute is genetics, and the way the randomness of the gene pool is very helpful. And siblings do not procreate. First cousins need to be very careful because the gene pool is too limited. And a wider randomness, chaos, is healthier for the species. And I don't mean this too seriously, but no extra charge, okay, before you demand your money back. As I move through the Lutheran Church, I sometimes wonder if the gene pool is wide enough. You know, there is kind of a vague resemblance everywhere you go, and I just wonder about that. I mean, that's more on the herding sheep line of the continuum. Anyway, we're in Mark 14, and we're going to listen this morning to the prayer of Jesus. I'm going to start with verse 26. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter said to him, Even though they all fall away, I will not. I started here before the prayer because we see so starkly and so clearly that there is a conflict of wills. Okay? There's not just one will in the universe or in the scripture or even in the life of Jesus. Jesus says to them, this is what's going to happen. And Peter, God bless him, stands up and says, no. I tell parents when we're preparing for baptisms in our church that it doesn't trouble me if their baby screams. Because my sense is that most of the time when God tells us to do something, that's our reaction. Poignant. And in this little paragraph, it doesn't just happen once, it happens twice. Here we go again. And Jesus said to Peter, Truly I say to you, this very night, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. But Peter said vehemently, If I must die with you, I will not deny you. And they all said the same. So we've got will. We've got strong will going on here. Words like vehement. And I think we've got a bit of a power struggle. And Jesus has said this is what's going to happen. And Peter is not accepting it. That's that. And they went to a place which was called Gethsemane. And Jesus said to his disciples, Sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. Those of you who have been here in the earlier sessions know I'm going to ask you to pay attention to the verbs. It's the room in prayer for distress and trouble. But for that matter, it's a room in the will of God for distress and trouble. And Jesus said to them, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Sorrow. Prayer is sorrowing, the expression of sorrow. Remain here and watch. And going a little farther, Jesus fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, All things are possible to thee. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. I want us to pay careful attention here to the words. The flesh is not the same word as the body. That sometimes we would hear those as synonyms. I'm convinced the New Testament uses the word flesh very specifically. When it uses the word body, it uses it very positively. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. You are the body of Christ. Does the eye say to the ear? The body is held in very high regard. The flesh is something else. It is this will, it's this power that would defy God, that would resist. What we were talking about, the power struggle, is also going to cite St. Paul, because it's another passage that parallels this one, though we're not reading it. In Romans 7, he says, The good I would, I do not, and what I would not, that I do. That's where we hear flesh. It's the intent that is so clear, and the flesh is weak. However you define that combination of self, that doesn't quite pull it off. See, rationalism made a separation, and that's that some of what got us started negating the body, that the, you know, the mind was clear, but the body was weak. Well, I don't hear that this way at all, and I'm much too close to a rich conversation about anorexia to let us just hear that sort of negation of the body. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. We started with a conflict of wills between Jesus and Peter. This puts a conflict of will kind of internally. And I guess I think that's real. I'm glad the Bible knows about that. And again, Jesus went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And Jesus came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." What do you see? How do you picture the scene? How do you see Jesus as he prays? What sorts of descriptions would you be willing to offer?
Alone, and maybe a little scared.
Okay.
Disappointed.
Yeah. Disappointed. In God or in the disciples?
Disciples.
Yeah, okay.
I see him as resolute and accepting of this situation.
Okay. You see that all the way through?
No. His resolution is, "I'll do it if I have to." Mm-hmm. Then he becomes resolute and he says, "You know, I've been betrayed, I'm going to do it."
Mm-hmm. I don't think it happens without some wrestling. If there's some tension, "God, I know this is your will, but I don't know if I can do it."
Yeah, lots of anguish.
Anguish, yeah. What does he look like?
Sad. Dismayed.
Sweating.
Right. Sweating.
His hair is all messed up.
His hair is all messed
up. We could hold it.
Come on. You think there's a reason they use audio tapes? You know, the scripture says he fell on the ground. I think that's very descriptive. There's a person at 7:45 that offered something I found very helpful. It was the dimension of time. She said, "You know, this passage moves way too quickly. At the end of some of the phrases, there is only a semicolon." And her comment took me into the theater. And for Minnesota, I imagine the Guthrie, it's got this marvelous thrust stage, so the actor is right in the middle of the audience. And I picture a very skilled actor able to say the line, and the line is pretty short, "Let this cup pass." And then the real acting, the real power comes in the pause, you know, in the nonverbals that express the distress and the anguish. There are artists who do paint Jesus here resolute and accepting, you know, looking up, hands open, able to accept. Maybe by the end. But in the beginning, I guess I picture him more with his head in his hands. There's somebody at 7:45 who said, even in a fetal position. And I was teasing them, I do not picture someone who's making a commercial for facial cosmetics, you know? I mean, sometimes you see that there's not a line in his face. I think there are real deep wrinkles in his face. What else do you see?
in the actual prayer, it seems if we're talking about the will of God or things being set or not set, it seems he's quite aware or speaking of a fluidity. All things are possible. That it isn't necessarily set.
Yes.
And that that he can then voice his own will and then rest trustingly in God's doing of it. But there isn't, I don't hear in here any sense of, although he already said that things would happen, there isn't a sense of there's something being absolutely set.
I believe he has options. God has options, yeah. That there are very real alternatives that appear godly and good and helpful. We imagine that Jesus is about 33 years old, you know. And I can hear in his prayer this resolve to live and to believe that God is about life and God makes us alive to make a difference. And Jesus has done that. His life matters. And how then that life is to be served is a very real question. I agree with you. This is not a kind of stage exercise. It's a very real decision of which of these options will I allow? Will I participate in? What is my next step? I don't know that if it was read at announcements. I didn't hear announcements at breakfast. But my consciousness is so often taken to this passage on oncology wards, where there is the same kind of desire to live and willingness to fight and to persevere, not only in the person who's diseased, but in all the people who are gathered around. And at the same time, there are the times that treatment is not going well. The disease is progressing. And in some cases, the treatment is as agonizing as the disease. And when I'm with people and I hear the oncologist say, well, you know, the CAT scan demonstrates that this approach has not impacted the progression. And there, you know, there may be a protocol in New York or Chicago or somewhere, and we can try that. I guess it's up to you. And there's a decision that needs to be made, and it's a very real decision. And it's real agony over what is faithful. Do you keep fighting? Do you resist? Or do you accept? I think those places would be well named Gethsemane Hall. That we have here this wrestling for what is the will, what is the guidance, what's the step, what's the decision, what's best. And I believe it's very real for Jesus. I'm grateful for your comments because I hear them as incarnational. Incarnation means God in the flesh. We believe that Jesus is God and human. And I hear here a person in prayer. And it's marvelous because this person prays for the will of God. I participated in too many will of God discussions that left the incarnation in the dust. You know, left real human circumstances and human distress and anguish and limitations and mortality in the dust. And all of that is here. And it's Jesus himself who prays and pleads that somehow it may pass. Let it stop. There's got to be another way.
All four Gospels several times point out that that's what Jesus has explained several times. I am pointed towards it. I'm pointed towards the cross.
Yes.
You just don't get it. So I don't see where you come up with the option that he had. I've never understood this if you couch it that way.
Okay. It's one thing to know where you're going. It's another thing to go there.
Correct. But I personally think they've discussed this before.
Okay. Well, we'll want to talk about the disciples too. But I don't think we're quite through talking about Jesus yet. I mean, your comment helps me know we're not quite through talking about them. You're right. Jesus has said this three times in the Gospel of Mark and in each of the synoptics after Mark. And each time the disciples have said no, and each time there is some really significant teaching about what it means to be a disciple. It means to lay down your life. Okay? That's what it means. But I believe in the incarnation fully enough to know that Jesus also shares this intensity that's beyond knowing. It's like saying, you know it's 2,000 feet to Holden Lake, and then you're on switchback 24. Okay? But it's different. Or, I mean, I'm thinking about a friend of mine who had lupus, and it created kidney failure. And her brother was able to be a donor. And their mom was telling me about the operation. You know, she said, it's really something to have two of your kids in surgery at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it's a kind of concrete expression of this laying down of one's life, which is part of the passion predictions and the discipleship teachings that have led to this. But when it comes down to doing it, I guess I want Jesus' struggle so that we can have the gift of his struggle when we face it, when we find it harder to do what we thought we were going to do, harder to die. I mean, this is again a way about dying well. And we all know we're going to die, right? That news to anybody this morning? Anybody come not knowing that? But you're not going to?
No.
Okay, well then you don't need your money back.
No.
Or maybe you do need your money back because you don't need this study. but if we find it harder to do than we thought it would be, then we have a gift of a Savior, don't we? In this prayer, and in the gift of prayer that is modeled in Gethsemane, that says, no, not yet, I'm not ready, I mean, let it pass, come on, God, that persistence of life, and that humility that begins to discover it may need to be already, even for people who are only 30. That still happens. Not my will, but your will be done.
Don't you think that part of the struggle that maybe you might be feeling too is a lot of times people take the attitude, well, he was God after all. So
yes.
It's going to be much easier for him. But if we accept him as a human being, he couldn't. I mean, even though that element is there, we in faith, can sometimes have that element too. Well, of course, this is going to happen and God's going to help us, but it doesn't make it any easier for us to do. And I think when we forget that Jesus was a human being, then you have to allow for that. I mean, like the picture in the garden where he's looking up, okay, you know, I know the picture you're talking about. Well, that's just not, that doesn't help us as human beings.
Well, and why do we want it easy for God?
Mm-hmm.
That is a curious thing for faithful people to want. Do you really want the agonies of dying?
They are very real. I have seen them, though I have not yet experienced them. And I've seen it enough to know that other people who had seen it found it harder to experience than to watch. Why would we want that to be easy for God? I mean, even if we do deny his humanity, think of the depth of God's compassion that we diminish in making it resolve kind of painlessly. There is power, I think, in Jesus' need to pray it three times. That repetition, it is not instantaneous resolution, though I have some questions about the three times. I mean, I think 300 would be a better number. Maybe it would take at least 300 times to say. Though maybe it's three times each setting or something like that. But you hear what I'm saying? How many times do you need to ask before you can accept? Well, I think some of that depends where you start. If you start without, you know, in complete denial that you will ever have to die, it will no doubt take you more than three times. But you hear what's modeled in the prayer beneath the will and in service of the will that I think can't be choreographed so precisely so that what's in front of you says exactly the same thing as what's behind you. If there is this wrestling.
You wonder how many times he prayed the prayer before he got to the garden.
Well, yeah. How many times he prayed the prayer when he was teaching?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think this is the first time.
Yeah.
But the ultimate question that we all seek is how did he know the answer? What was the response? And he seemed to accept it when he says, oh, here they are. I got your answer.
Yeah, he does seem to accept it, though there are still going to be more prayers, you know. And they will include, my God, why have you forsaken me? That is a prayer. And so what is acceptance, and how do we know, and how did that come? That's a very real question.
Okay, but he also finishes up and says, there, it's done.
Then he says, it's done.
Yeah, we did it.
Yeah. Enough, enough. It's a wonderful word. Enough. How do you see the disciples?
Tired.
Confused and tired. Somebody at 7:45 reminded me they'd just been to Passover, which includes the drinking of quite a substantial amount of wine. Descriptions?
Resistant.
Do they get it yet?
They don't get it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. They do not get it. And there is some tension between Jesus and the disciples, don't you think? I mean, there's tension between Jesus and God, I think, in the prayer. And I also hear a profound tension between Jesus and the disciples.
Well, it's kind of like trying to explain immortality or mortality to a teenager who thinks that they're going to live forever, or for us, for that matter. I asked a 93-year-old woman one time if she ever thought of dying and thought about dying, and she said no. No matter how long we live, we really think that that's not going to happen. And we thought that their work was going to die, they just thought, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. See,
an old person that doesn't buy green bananas.
Because they're going to die before the bananas would be ripe.
Oh. Okay.
I like the words here. I think one of the things we see in the disciples, one of the things we see is obtuseness. They don't get it. One of the other things we see is failure of will. All that is asked of them is to watch, to stay awake. I think it's a fairly modest request. And I like to think that most of us want to believe that by sheer resolve, we could keep ourselves awake. You know, that's not, you can't. But that's, the thing that's so interesting is that if we just talk about will of God as a topic, My sense is that most of us move to walking on water or moving mountains. You know, this kind of grandiose, change the world. This text asks nothing like that of the disciples. It says, watch, stay awake, pray. Yesterday we had the verb see, that maybe prayer is alertness, okay? Awareness, just be aware of what's happening.
I think maybe that's a little unfair for the disciples, because I know personally, if you're fatigued, the hardest thing to do is nothing.
Yeah.
He didn't ask them to march, to stand guard, he just said watch. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be the hardest thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Okay. So I'll give you that. I'll say doing nothing is more powerful than my own resolve. Isn't that an interesting statement of trust? Trust asks us to do nothing. It's harder than my resolve and more powerful than my resolve. I think that's true.
I think they were very confused and depressed at that point. They didn't understand. And they had expected Christ to become more of a king, to stay around for a while and, you know, do more wonderful things.
Yeah.
Very depressed because he kept saying, I'm going to die.
Well, and every, you know, we see two things in this conversation. I'm glad we've broadened this out to a wider conversation than just in Gethsemane. That Jesus keeps saying it, and they keep saying no. No, it's not going to happen. And I do feel some empathy for them. They have staked their lives on this teacher. Imagine someone on whom you depend the most. And this person is trying to tell you, no, it's going to end now. No, you've got to do this on your own. And they're not hearing it.
Paul, I just wanted to say, I think it might be more to think that what Jesus was requesting of the disciples really was not nothing, because watch, I think, also has another level.
Yes, it does.
Being with him and accompanying him in these last hours or days, and staying awake to that is not simply a physical staying awake, but staying awake spiritually to what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we see the disciples acting with an extreme passivity.
Yeah.
What you were saying before about the flesh taking over, which I think adds to the extreme loneliness of Jesus in the situation.
Oh, I think so too.
It's not really doing nothing that he's asking of them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy.
No, good.
But there's a difference between doing nothing and accompanying.
And your saying that helps us validate what is important discipleship, which is to be alert to one another and awake. I think we wish discipleship could be to heal one another. That would be good. To save one another, that would be even better. But when we can do that, we can at least be alert to, awake to, watchful with. And it is very important at a bedside for the person in the bed and the person beside the bed. I'm convinced of that. And so to say that is prayer. And prayer is that. Prayer is watching, being alert. One of the things that I think is happening is that I think we can see in the disciples the human capacity to filter messages. See, they've had these other messages, but they've had other messages too. You know, they've had the message that not a sparrow falls, but the Father knows. And consider the lilies and God's care for them. And it's amazing how when we don't want to see what we have to see, we cling to that, you know, to some part of the message, even if it's the wrong part of the message at the moment. My breakfast conversation this morning was with a group of people who had bad dreams. There's a person in the village who survived the eruption of Mount Rainier last night. And this was heavy duty. And I'm not sure, but what it set off an earthquake up in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. You know, there's a fault there. It was just cataclysmic. And it was sort of interesting. The worst dream I've ever had in my life was a recurrent dream in high school. And I was in the balcony of my home church playing the piano, where I was often. And the balcony was sloped. You know, it had the theater seating. And as I was playing, the piano began rolling down the slope. And one of my piano teacher's mantras was, whatever happens, don't break the rhythm. So I didn't. I just keep playing. And, you know, we're rolling down the balcony and go crashing through the rail, and then I would wake up, you know, landing down in the nave. Well, I'm pretty convinced that if that happened, my piano teacher's advice to me would not be keep the rhythm. Get out of the way. Is also sage advice, don't you think? But it's the capacity to kind of grip part of the message. And I hope if you think I'm being hard on the disciples, you can hear that as being merciful to the disciples, that we are able to do that. We are able to hear either what we most want in the message or what we most dread. It's real interesting to me to listen to what people, and you know, we've talked about cancer. This isn't only about cancer. It could be about any kind of malady. What they do with numbers. And how sometimes, even if they know there's only a 15% chance of recovery, they'll hold that 15% for all they are worth. Or even if the treatment is going very well, and they know there's only a 3 or a 5% chance of recurrence, they will be haunted by that. You see what I mean? That it's, we are not, I really wonder how helpful the numbers even are. I think the mystery is a lot more helpful to say, well, we really don't know. You know, we'll pray, we'll be attentive, we'll watch. I think it may be a more helpful message. What? You don't think so?
People like absolutes.
They like numbers. Yeah, but the numbers aren't absolute.
I know, but it gives them some concrete belief.
Yeah. We like specificity. That's true. Maybe it's easier to be awake to specifics. And, you know, ambiguity. It's harder to be awake to ambiguity. And at the very least, this whole scene is ambiguous, don't you think? To Jesus and to the disciples. Any more you want to say about the disciples? Go ahead.
I guess the other half of the message was that they were going to desert him. And that has to be a really hard thing to receive and deal with. I mean, your resistance to, no, I won't, I'm with you.
Yeah.
So I think that's even a bigger part of where they're, what they're feeling.
We tend to act out the messages we're given.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, don't spill your milk. Instead of, you know, be careful.
Yeah, right. There is some power in that. Well, we've talked some about who Jesus is, and we've talked some about who the disciples are. Having spun that a bit, I'd like to come back in conclusion to think about who Jesus is, because if the disciples are not able by will to keep themselves awake, if they are not alert, if they are in denial, which reminds you, there's one other thing I was going to say about denial. I'm a person who learned about, and learning it out of a book, I thought it was a horrible thing and that nobody should be in denial. Having experienced a few things, I can appreciate the mercy of denial. And the way it is a genuine coping for something that would be too painful all at once.
I think being stuck in denial is real dangerous. But being in denial is real, and we can only absorb, be alert to, see, work through so much at a time. So denial can be a real merciful thing, and I don't want our discussion about disciples in denial being only critical. I mean, they could not, even by will. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, is right here. But anyway, though they could not, though they did not, I hear here a Jesus who is very alert, very awake, very aware. And for that, I am deeply grateful. When I am a disciple, and you know, we all the way through this, in each of the stories, we've had people who don't get it. You know, remember Elkanah and Eli on Monday? And you're next to somebody, and you know they need support, and you know they're feeling really alone, and you want to. And you know you just aren't really hearing it quite right. It is such gospel to me to be able to say, I believe fully that Jesus is awake to this, that Jesus is alert, that Jesus wrestles and struggles, throws himself on the ground, says it again and again and again. I think there is great gospel here for our loneliness. When the people around us, I mean, when it's too painful for the people closest to us to face up to what we're going through right now, to know that Jesus is with us, that one of his names is Emmanuel, and that a piece of prayer is being given his alertness, even when we don't have our own, and when we can't describe it ourselves, and when we cannot know. There, I think we've got some real powerful pieces of a will that holds chaos and order together, and that loves life and knows that every living thing dies and promises still to be with and to redeem, to bring back again. There's lots of promise for me in this wonderful prayer of Jesus, who is awake to his own agony, alert and aware. And that's where I really hear the contrast. And I think there's some struggle between Jesus and his God, Jesus and his Father, too. And then there's a struggle between Jesus and the disciples. And it's Jesus' alertness and awareness and expressiveness of all of that that I find very enriching in prayer. Comments or questions about that or about anything that we've not kind of touched on?
I think it's significant too that this all happened in the night.
I do too.
Because I think it's in the night where most of us struggle the most. In which those anxieties and fears come out and it's like, oh, we thought we resolved those. And here it comes at full force again. And again, going back to the gospel, Christ is there with us in the night when we think we're all alone. And when we cry out, there's Christ hearing us.
That moves on so many levels. Part of it is that we are also vulnerable in the night, very vulnerable when we cannot see. And Jesus here is very vulnerable. You know, he has gone to the garden to pray before. He is not hiding. And this is quickly going to become a military picture, you know, where you put out sentries and guards at night because you're vulnerable. And you're vulnerable to those darknesses around. But the other side of it that you have described so powerfully is that when the sensual stimuli around us are shut down and you can't see, then there's the darkness within that surfaces and that.
The psychic level light is, of course, when our conscious defenses are relaxed, denial, barking, whatever they may be, no longer in play. Forces of the unconscious come up. We're most vulnerable to them.
We have bad dreams. Isn't it? But I do think it is significant that it happens in the night. And I think it is the center of the gospel that God is in the night and that God knows the darkness. I agree with you. Any other comments? I thank you again for your participation in attentiveness to the prayer of our own Savior. And tomorrow we will be attentive to the prayer of St. Paul. We'll use the "Do not put us to the test," or "Save us from the trial," "Lead us not into temptation." And we'll listen to Paul's thorn in the flesh. So, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Okay. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.